Hey, Dave, this is Marconi. How are you?
Hey, Marconi. Are you from the Marconi Awards?
I am playing the Mamba and listening to the radio right now. Hey, Martin.
Yeah, is that Jay?
Yes, Martin. How you doing?
I'm good, Shane. You sound like you're on the moon. Screaming there.
Really? I sound like I'm on the moon?
Shane is the man in the moon on a Friday.
Oh, I know. I just heard, hey!
Hey, everybody. This is Joel Linter. Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford.
The Rudy Sergeant.
Hey, this is Steve Hackett.
You folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph. And we're talking rock with Dave and Shane.
Talk about some of the music you're working on. I mean, you're always inspired, and you're also a podcaster. Welcome to the podcast world, Radio Owl's Nest, episode 45.
It's been it was a hobby of mine. It was just a lot of fun. I've been one of those songwriters that kept all his demos. So I kept records of everything, and I just one day was sat down and, having to move into Pro Tools and the digital world, and I was able to transfer with an engineer's help all my original demos, even from the first days I started in the late 70s, over to digital. And, I started to listen to them, and I thought, wow, I forgot about that one, I forgot about this, and I just thought it would be wonderful to, in a way, do a songwriter's podcast that let people hear the demos, hear the raw beginnings of songs before they were recorded by people professionally. So it's been a lot of fun. I thought I was going to do one, and here I am at 45. I'm pretty sure that I'll probably stop around 50. That's been my goal, to reach 50. I mean, I'm sure you guys have gone on and on, but I was expecting to do one, and here I am, as you say, sort of 4 years down the line. But it's always fun to me. It's like being a kid in a playground,
Oh, yeah. It's a great listen.
Sorry?
They're addictive, aren't they?
Yeah, you're addicted to hearing your own voice. And I find out it's quite strange. You're sat in a room on your own talking to yourself, and you go, it's strange. I can get off on my own in a small room. This is really weird. I thought they could put me in a submarine and I'd still be joking. This is weird. I mean, you guys know what it's like, when you get a little bit of feedback as well. I've been lucky because it's just a small following, but they're very loyal and they've followed me for many years. So it's a fun thing. I sort of stop in my writing every once a week in a month, and I'll put a show together. And I even discover demos that I didn't know I still had. So it's interesting for me as well on that count. I listen to them, and some of the songs I go, my God, that's terrible. Another time I go, my God, that's better than the record. So it's an interesting museum journey, really.
Does it take you back when you, when you find an old demo, does it take you back to that place and that time when you wrote it?
It really does, Dave. I mean, it's a funny thing. I'm so dedicated to music. It sort of brings home to you. Here I am, in my 60s, and I'm looking back to times when I was writing these songs and when I was 18. And I remember Paul McCartney once said that when he heard some of the early Beatles tracks, he said, my God, we were really good then, And I have a little bit of feeling like that sometimes. When I play the demo of We Built This City and These Dreams, which, went on to be number one songs, when I did the demos, I thought they were so amateurish. And when I played them to people, I was a little bit embarrassed because it was just 8-track and just me with the keyboard. It wasn't really polished. And now, like Paul McCartney listening to the Beatles, when I listen to those songs, I sort of amazed at how clever they are and how disciplined they were on a small 8-track recording. I'm sort of sometimes a little bit overwhelmed with how focused I was as a young man doing those demos, because I now see them like a different person. I sort of listen to them and go, I can see why people were attracted to the demo of We Built This City. There's a lot of energy, and it's very well arranged. So over time, your perspective on songs changes. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Now, how many of those demos, Martin, were instrumental, and how many were vocal? Is it pretty even, or because I know every couple of years you put out an ambient record or an instrumental album.
Well, that's an interesting question, Shane, because I've only really started doing instrumental tracks in the last sort of 3 to 4 years. In the early days, it was all about song singing. It's all about that for me when I started. We were really looking for commercial success, myself and my songwriter partner, Brian Fairweather. We were really just trying to be songwriters. And so all the songs from the past are me writing. It's interesting listening to the demos over the years and doing this podcast is that there were so many different styles, and that's been one of my sort of revelations to myself, because I bought so many records. I was a real collector of vinyl, so I was very influenced by the records I bought. So one song would sound, you know, like the Beatles, one song would sound like the funk and Stevie Wonder, one song would sound, you know, like maybe folk oriented. So I was right across the board. That was very interesting to me. But as I got older in the last 2 or 4 years, I sort of had a desire to do some ambient instrumental music, because when I was at art college in the 70s, we were listening to bands like Tangerine Dream and Krautrock, and a lot of unusual music was coming through in the 70s, Tubular Bells. And so it was a fancy of mine to try and do that, and I've enjoyed that process as well. But no, the demos in the early days were all singing, yeah.
Mm. That's
fine. That process of going from a demo to, you know, cutting the track, can you talk about, especially for These Dreams and We Built This City, what was it like for you to go from that demo process to see the track cut and recorded, mixed and mastered? What was that like for you?
It was pretty magical and fascinating at that time, because those two particular songs, I'd only been in LA for maybe a year, and I was trying to break through, and suddenly a publisher put me with Bernie Taupin, Elton's lyricist, and Bernie was interested in working with me, and I was from a sort of new wave techno band, a band called Q-Feel. So we were using synthesizers, and we'd broken through on K-Rock in LA with a song called Dancing in Heaven. So it was a risk for him. They were trying to make Bernie move into the future by working with me. We met up, we got on, and then he just gave me two lyrics up front, which were like testing lyrics to see if he wanted to work with me. And they both were We Built the City and These Dreams. And of course, I wanted to impress Bernie. So my demos were, even though they were on 8-track at home and just in my living room, I worked hard on them. And suddenly, We Built the City was taken by, at first, the Motels. The Motels were interested in recording it. And I was thrilled, because it proved to Bernie Taupin that if he worked with me, other bands would want to cut our songs. And he was breaking away from Elton for a while. Then Starship took an interest. And I went to the studio just to hear the track being built up. And I knew the keyboard player who was producing it, Peter Wolf, an Austrian producer. And he was copying a lot of what I did from the demo, but also sort of making it a little bit more, I suppose, commercial and rock-oriented for Starship. And I'll be real honest with you, when they called me down to the studio at the end of doing it, Starship were excited, and Grace Slick was saying, listen to this, we think we've got something special. And I remember thinking, I don't think it's as good as my demo. I remember thinking, this is crap. And I didn't think much of it. I thought it was like a German march. You know, I thought it was too stiff, because my little demo was a bit like Shock the Monkey by Peter Gabriel. It was a bit more funky and dark. Mm. And Bernie even liked the demo, because we sort of we swung it a bit more. And I was a bit like, what a shame. You know, they haven't done it how I would have liked it to be. But I think I've said it many times, as soon as it went up the charts and gets near to number one, and I was hearing it all the time, I started to appreciate that it was pretty good. And it was doing the job, you know. But it was quite strange, Dave, to hear what you did in a living room, you know, one keyboard on a little Fostex quarter-inch tape machine, suddenly become animated to 48 tracks in a large studio, and to see it race up the American charts so fast. Even now, you know, over 40 years, We Built the City is still being, is still a resonance. It's ridiculous. It's you know, first song I ever wrote with Bernie, and 40 years, and it's still, we get, you know, it being requested for movies and TV as an advert. You know, about 4 or 5 years ago, it was number one in England at Christmas with an artist called Lad Baby, who changed the lyrics to "We built this city on sausage rolls," you know, and and now there's an advert going around that said we built this city on repairing toilets, and I'm like, how did this all happen? You know?
Yeah.
I'm in Detroit. We built the city on cars, the motor city.
You know, I think it's just the right title. I thought Bernie must have come up with it. And you know, they've always got to ask Bernie's you know, favorable response for going forward, and he seems to say that it's the song that never stops giving. So, you know, we're quite pleased that it's had a life this long. But I think he had the right title there. We built the city on anything. I mean, you just fill the word in and we're away. You know,
great. It's brilliant.
Did you have an idea, Martin, that was going to be such an earworm that was just going to, it was going to stand the test of time? Did you have a good feeling?
No, Shane. No, I had no bloody idea at all. I must admit, I had one job to do, and that was to make a song appeal to Bernie. And I had to send a cassette to Bernie's house. We weren't real friends. We'd met up, and this was a tester. And then when he got the cassette, he called me on the phone and said, you know, Bernie Taupin comes into the 80s. He was very pleased with it. I was basically trying to make a very atmospheric track. I mean, people should listen to the demo. It's on my website, but the demo had a darker element to it. I was very influenced at that time by Tom Dolby and his album, The Golden Age of Wireless. And so his tracks, you know, like One of Our Submarines and Wind Power and Blinded by Science, I was really very influenced, thinking he's made a very exceptional melodic high-tech record. And so We Built This City was a mixture for me of rhythmic Peter Gabriel and the kind of, now I look back, the melodic and romanticism of the Buggles and Tom Dolby. So I did, for a band like Starship to do it, I just thought, no way, you know, that's a rock band that I'm not crazy about Starship, you know, who are they? And my head was in Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark and Thompson Twins and my band Q-Feel. So when I finished it, I just wanted to excite people. I had no idea, Shane. No, I mean, I talk to my manager now about it, Diane. I just say, I can't, when she calls me and says, there's another movie wanting these, once we built the city, another advert, I just go, I can't fathom how one song. And it's interesting, you know, I meet people on the street and you're talking to them and they go, what do you do? You say, I'm a songwriter. And they go, yeah. Well, what did you write? And I go, we built the city. We built this city. They're all it's like my gardener knows it and the poor man does. It's my car. It's my calling card, you know?
Yeah.
It's strange when you write a, I mean, I've written a few that have done that, but, you know, I mean, when we think about Elton John and the Beatles, they've written so many of them. But when you've written one song that everybody seems to know, it's a strange feeling, because I had, again, to your question, Shane, when I finished it, I didn't even think it was that commercial. I just thought it was going to excite people and make Bernie Taupin want to work with me again.
Yeah.
Interesting. Go ahead, Shane, go ahead.
No, I just, do you kind of look at that song now, Martin, as like, it's no longer yours? We've heard that a lot before, when a song gets so big, it's just, it's out of you, it's away from you now, it's everyone.
That's such an interesting question, so I've never been asked that before, and I've never really thought about it before. But, you know, just thinking about that now, in a way, I'd say, yeah, you know, I see it as me and Bernie's song, but as you say, I sort of feel like it's been taken over by the world. When it's been a hit in England two times later than when it was released by Starship, and that's the young kids that discovering it again. You know, they found it all over again. So I think you're right. I think a part of me feels like that's the poem I started. That's the thing I started, but now it's everybody's. It's a great question, and it's the first time I've thought about that. But you're right. I don't think I took. I think it's everybody's, because even when people say to me, "Oh, yeah, we built this city," you know, I go into the dentist, and the dentist says, "You know, oh, I love we built this city," you know, and another person they go, "I loathe it. I hate it." It's one of those kinds of songs. One of those kinds of songs that seems to, you know, be in everybody's life in some form. It is, I think, everybody. It does seem to have gone into a different place. Even Diane said there's probably a chance that it's going to be put into some kind of award for being iconic of the era of the 80s. You know, it seems to be becoming an iconic sign of what the 80s were, good or bad. So, yeah, you're right, Shane. I think I sort of share it now. I seem to think that it's everybody's as well, yeah.
Is it? And you still have some of the same – I remember there was a video you did. By the way, I'm looking on Spotify. 465 million plays just on Spotify. We built the city, and it's just – I mean, that's
wow.
Incredible. Yeah.
I know. It's you know, so in awesome. England, I was just told, you know, in England that it's become a platinum single in England, which is 600,000 –
wow.
Sold of the actual single. You know, you don't get platinum singles in England. So, yeah, it's stunning to me. It's stunning, stunning.
Is there you did a video, I think, a couple of years ago. You showed us, I think it was the Owl's Nest, some of the Moogs and the
yeah.
synthesizers. Do you still have – it was amazing. Like and they're all on these neat, organized shelves, the original keyboard that you used for a lot of these songs. Do you still have the one that you did the demo for We Built the City on?
Oh! Yeah, it's right next to it's right and prominent next to my board now, my Jupiter 8.
Amazing,
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, my Jupiter. Yeah, and it can't be sort of linked up to Play in Sync to Pro Tools because it was before MIDI was made.
Right.
And there it is. It's a little bit dented and knocked about, and I believe they're selling them now. I've had people try to buy it off me for something like, you know, $17,000.
Wow.
20 grand, and I would never sell it. It's there, and funny enough, my partner from my Q-Fill days, Brian Fairweather, right back from that period, he's about to work with me again next week, and we're going to be using, yes, that keyboard again that we used for Dancing in Heaven and for We Built the City and for
wow.
Ghostbusters
oh, wow.
when we worked with Ray Parker. So, yeah, it's wonderful, Shane. I mean, one of my things is that even for your eyes, when I walk into my studio, even though it has to be digital and it has to be, you know, linked up to Pro Tools and DAWs, I like to see the vintage keyboards and the vintage microphones, and I still use them, and they make a big difference when you play them on digital recording because they still have the oscillators and the beef and the preamps that make the analog sound so much more richer and there's chaos in these keyboards. You know, these records which we made back then in analog, they were all very, very different sounding because you can't really organize analog sounds as much as you can digital. And that's what we liked about it, that they were very original. And analog recordings is chaotic because you never really get the same sound twice. But that's a lot of fun. And I like twiddling knobs. I like playing with all the... Jupiter knobs and seeing what kinds of sounds we can get. It's still in me. It makes me feel like a kid. So when I walk into the studio most days, I look at these old keyboards and they inspire me a great deal.
And they hold up, right? As far as that, I mean, they hold up so well. They were built so well.
That's right, Shane. I mean, Brian, as I said, my partner, I played him some new stuff I was working on. I said, I'm only using the Jupiter 8 again. I said, I'm making a record around the edges, but just the Jupiter 8, just because it's great. I have to work it. I have to play it. I can't get away with it. It's not AI. I have to play this thing, and I have to work it like a machine. And he was thrilled. And the sounds, yeah, I'm recording it now. I mean, this last two, and next week I'll be recording it as well. It's the new keyboard to me that I'm using again. It's funny you brought that up. I've moved it right up to being the keyboard that I want to work on because it tests me. I have to program it, which is a half the fun, you know.
Yeah.
you talked about Tubular Bells. You talked about LMD, Thompson Twins. Do you have a favorite out of all of your equipment? Do you have a favorite synth that you just absolutely love that sound, that feel that you get from it?
Well, it's going to have to be that one, you know, that I started with right back in when I first came to America, the Jupiter 8. The two keyboards I love the best is the Jupiter 8, and I've got an Oberheim 6. You know, they're making when I recorded in England, Dancing in Heaven, the hit that brought me to America with my band Q-Feel, we used both those keyboards, the Jupiter 8 and the Oberheim 8. And they've just made again the Oberheim 8. It's come out again. But I've got an Oberheim 6 in the studio as well. So my two favorite keyboards are the Oberheims and the Jupiters. They were iconic in the 80s. You hear them on most of the records. They were just so powerful for that era. And they really were a breakthrough in polyphony, you know, in the sense that you could, your left hand could be playing the bass, your right hand could be playing melodies and chords. And when I was settled in America, I couldn't bring over a Jupiter 8, so I had to save my money up from my first sessions and buy one in L.A. And that's still the one I've got now, and it's the one that I used with Earth, Wind & Fire, the Commodores, and it's there. It's one of the first Jupiter 8s, so it didn't have the MIDI connections to it, which made it it could be programmed and sequenced. So mine is one of those originals that is just, you have to play it, and you have to build a unit for it to be synced up in perfect time. But what I've always enjoyed about the Jupiter 8 is it made me play. I mean, the demo on We Built the City, the drum machine is programmed, but none of the keyboards are synced. I played all of that live. And so it brought back, and in fact, my a Radio Owl's Nest podcast show that's out now that came out a week ago, I talk about tightness in records, you know, like Steely Dan. And in the 80s, we had to play a lot of these synthesizer parts live. We were more dexterous on the keyboards. We were much more sharper on playing rhythmic parts. And we've all got a little bit sloppy over the years because everything is, you know, controlled by Pro Tools and sequences are already there, already programmed before you just hold one note and off you go. But in our day, in the 80s, you know, in my We Built the City demo, although it sounds high tech and high synced up, it was all basically played live. And so it's fun for me to go back to that a little bit where we say, oh, we could quantize this, couldn't we? We go, yeah, but let's not quantize it. Let's play it as good as we can on a synthesizer. And again, you start to get, even on synthesizers, you start to get a real human feel. And that's something that I still enjoy to this day.
Mm. That's amazing. What I love is how the evolution of technology, how I think for a long time, really, I guess, even until now, like it's, but especially in that era, that helped in the creativity. Like I remember the guys in Judas Priest talking about when they first got synthesizer guitars and you know, that really inspired the Turbo album with very unique sounds. That's such a unique thing.
It's a huge thing, you know, and I was recently talking to a couple of people about this, that synthesizers will always remain modern. They will always become whatever you do with the synthesizer. Even now, if you listen to a lot of things that are in the charts, you can tell that a lot of the young artists are still leaning back to some of the work of the 80s. But you're totally right. When you listen to the Beatles doing Abbey Road, you can hear a Moog synthesizer being involved for the first time on Maxwell's Silver Hammer. You can hear just one Moog synthesizer is beginning to make everybody see differently. And I've always felt the philosophy of music has always been technology. Whatever the technology does at the time the songwriters and the artists are working, it influences the music. You know, when you think about Beethoven and Bach and Mozart, you know, it was new technology to have a violin, new technology to have a cello. Everything was very modern in those, to them at that time. And so when synthesizers came into the picture, it was a game changer. And you're right, one keyboard for me. I had a Jupiter 8 and all my songs, all my hits were on one keyboard. You know, you concentrated on that one keyboard to do everything, even the drum sounds. And when I worked with Earth, Wind & Fire, they were trying to change their sound, you know, and so were the Commodores. All these funk bands were trying to say we have to move forward with what synthesizers and technology can do. But you're absolutely right. Technology rules music. I really, you know, when you think about that, I was on analog. I've still got my Studer 24 track here in the room because I like to stare at it and touch it. I had to move into the Pro Tools era, and there's good things about digital and there's terrible things about digital. You know, it's 50-50 in my book, but you can't, you have to negotiate it as a songwriter. And I think if you listen to the 50s music, you know, and Glenn Miller, you can hear that suddenly they're recording themselves and it's all in mono, but they're having to, you know, put that one microphone in the room and get the singer like Frank Sinatra at a certain place and all the band, you know, 100 feet away from them and balance it. It's all the records and all music has always been slightly led to me by technology. Every era of music, it shows us when we listen to that music, even from classical and folk music right on to now. You can almost say that the collaborator here with creative people is technology.
Well, you were always at the forefront of that technology and the innovation in music, and you used most of those tools back then. And sometimes you were one of the first people to use them. A lot of those bands that you were talking about, and you.
Yes.
Where do you see the, speaking of innovation, I mean, where do you see the world of music going right now with artificial intelligence? Are you a little concerned?
Yeah.
Are you?
I'm a little concerned. Yeah, I was reading recently what Sting was saying about it and Peter Gabriel. And, you know, Peter Gabriel is one of those people that's saying, you know, we've got to welcome it and develop it, and it's going to change everything. And there's Sting, as a songwriter, saying, you know, you can't take away the human element of songwriting. Otherwise, we'll lose that great individuality of what human emotion. And I tend to lean between both of them, really. I think it's something we can't stop, because when we think about it, Shane, you know, when drum machines came in, all the drummers were scared, and there we were programming drums as guitarists and bass players, and we were excited that we could use drum machines and make drums sound different. So there's nothing going to stop AI. There's nothing going to stop it. It's just that I think all the publishers and all the organizations that look after the rights of songwriters and creators have to look at this really, really, really carefully, because there's a great danger that we're just going to push a button and say there's a pop song, it's number one in the charts, and it's made by a robot. That worries me, because I do believe that the most important thing about art and music is human emotion. And I don't think at this point AI or any computer can put emotion into anything except for the human soul. So I think that we're right at that cusp where we have to really make sure, and all the organizations that look after the copyrights of songs and creators have to really study it hard, because I've had a few people say to me, hey, are you using AI, you know, and singing something into a microphone and then saying, make a song up from this. And I say to them, you know, I'm still trying to write a damn good song myself, you know. I'm still trying to learn how to do it on my own. I can see the temptation. But I can see that there will probably be some fantastic elements of it that will help production and songwriters. In fact, you know, as we know now, the Beatles are putting out another song that came from the John Lennon cassette, and they say that AI has been helping with that, because you can separate, you know, John's voice from off the cassette with any other sounds. And I can see that as being really, really useful. But I think it's going to come down to how we basically regulate it and make sure that still the artist, the creator, the songwriter, is allowed to put his emotion into his work and not to be cornered out of his job by a robot. you know. I think it's right on the cusp of having to really study it and look at it carefully. There's going to be great things about it, but there's also some very dangerous things about it as well.
And there's also, like, you know, it's funny because you're talking about copyright and just, you know, artists' rights, and that's always been an issue, you know, for artists. I mean, nowadays, of course, there's, you know, the terrible returns that are, you know, pennies on the dollar for, like, Spotify, that sort of thing. So it's like there's so many different fronts as it relates to artists' rights and copyright, all of these things. And then now you've got this thrown into it, which makes that whole field even more complex, it seems like.
It is. It has been a really, really tough period since really iTunes came about all those years ago of digital. Digital's made it very, very easy to hear millions of songs instantly, and it's taken a lot of reverence away from some pieces of special music. We're getting so much thrown at us, and it's so easy to pirate these things and not pay the composers and the artists. But it's been a really, really tough period since really digital came into the picture. It's a hard time for composers like myself and a lot of authors. You know, you're going to get the few very, 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 very big artists doing extremely well, and a lot of people underneath that not finding it hard to survive. My era, when I came into LA in the early 80s, songwriting was incredibly revered. And so you were able to go into record companies and meet the artists and write a song for them. It was very organic. Nowadays, you send things in on your email. There's no real human contact, and everything is made, you know, on a laptop, and the record that's number one is made on a laptop in somebody's kitchen. And maybe the voice has been recorded somewhere else and has been manipulated by auto-tune and various other processes. So I've always thought that humans wanted to end up being robots, and it seems like every year we push towards trying to be more like robots. And it's not brilliant for emotion, though. That's the key to me. The huge word is emotion. And why I, in my era now, I know things will change when we've all passed on, but you find with movies, they're still leaning back to put songs into movies which have lasting emotions. You tend to see records, you know, by Creedence Clearwater Revival, records by Marvin Gaye. You'll hear songs from the past because they resonate of human emotion. And that seems to be squeezed out a lot since we've been going through the streaming years. There's some great tracks appear here and there, but it's not easy, is it, really, to find Let It Be again, or Hey Jude, or to find Martin Luther John, and to find My Sweet Lord. It's not easy to find those songs quite as much now, and yet they are perennial songs. So for me, the moment that iTunes appeared and digital started to take over and phones started to take over, wonderful, wonderful in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways it took the reverence away from the art of recording and writing. You know, the album itself, the concept of the album, it's becoming a relic. You know, it's people don't really look upon albums these days as something that's really important, and yet it's an emotional statement. You know, we used to sit down in the 80s and 70s and 90s even and get lost in the artist's vision. Now it's very much like on streaming and Spotify that an artist has to throw out maybe 7 singles in 7 weeks, and whether that's going to be an album or not, we don't know. And a person could be huge on Spotify for 1 week and have incredible spins and streaming, and then next week they don't know who he is. It's gone. There's no artistic depth there. That's the problem with streaming, is it's not easy to fall in love with many, 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 many artists. You know, in our era, you'd have the Beach Boys, then you'd have Frank Zappa, the Beatles, and you might have some reggae, Bob Marley, whatever. But now, you know, you may have 4 or 5 or 6 huge, huge artists that continually eat up Spotify. And there may be some great music out there that we can't discover because there's just so much of it. The word is sort of reverence. And there is a danger, I think, with anything in life. If you have so much of it, you can't define what's good and what's bad. It's just too much of it. You're just overwhelmed with the choices. It's like like having a smart TV, isn't it? You've got everything under the sun, and then you sit there for 9 hours going, I don't know what I want to watch.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Oh, yeah. That's it. I find it daunting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, where do you start and where do you end, and that's why you might get some artists becoming, hugely successful, maybe 10, that own the streaming chart. And yet in an era like the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, there was a lot of choice and a lot of good stuff got through. Nowadays, it's great that anybody can make a record. I like the idea of that, but there's so much. I mean, I think I read somewhere that there's something like every day, over like 10,000 new tracks are downloaded to Spotify every day.
Wow. Unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah, it's something phenomenal. I might have got the numbers wrong there, but it is quite ridiculous. It's something either 1,000 or 10,000 new tracks are downloaded to Spotify every day. And then you go, well, where is the, what is good, what is bad? How do we make a choice? How do we know what we should be listening to? How can we be inspired? Yeah. Because it also can become too much for us to go through. We just go, I can't go through all that. It's too much. And then again, you lose maybe the Joni Mitchell. You may lose, as we said, the Marvin Gaye. You may lose the Stevie Wonder in the melee, in the chaos out there.
It's funny you say that because Steve Lukather talked about the exact same thing last week in Guitar.com. He said that if you don't have a million followers on Instagram right now, he's talking about the struggles of young musicians. If you don't have a million followers on Instagram, you could write a Sgt. Pepper's and nobody's going to take it.
It's very, very, very true. We sound like a bunch of old farts moaning about this day. But there's probably some truth to that. But it is, we are quite lucky to have gone through many eras. You're lucky if you're still doing music. I feel myself very, very lucky. I'm sure Steve Lukather feels very lucky that he's still doing it because one of the things about our era is that you can keep going. If you were an artist maybe in the 50s, no young fans would have looked at you past 48 years old or something. It definitely is that there's a nostalgia that happens by in this era. But it is true. We all get down to, unfortunately, with digital numbers. How many people looked at my video this week? How many people have ticked off my Instagram photograph? I mean, it's terribly, terribly numbing. And I don't think it's the truth out there, really. It's like numbers are telling us what we should think. So it's as Steve Lukather says, you've almost, one of the first things that maybe a young artist will think about is not the quality of how he writes the song or how he records it or what the song's about. It's like, what can I do to get, over a million followers? What will excite them quickly, like on TikTok? Maybe if I jump headlong off of a bridge into a car, I'll get some likes. I've tried it. It doesn't work. But it is a strange time for that. I think it must be. I say to my manager sometimes, I feel for young songwriters because in our day, we were able to go into record companies and have human contact with A&R departments that told us what they liked, what they didn't like. We would probably meet the artists, and we were having to learn our art really well. These days, it's much harder for a songwriter because it's so dominated by digital feedback, instantly going onto Spotify, instantly hitting Instagram, instantly hitting Facebook, Twitter, it's all very, very, very fast and instant. And a good point to make here, which might mean something to you guys, is I remember a really great filmmaker saying, once, and he was a tremendous filmmaker from the 60s, and they said, well, you could do your digital editing quicker, really fast and everything, like we do with music on Pro Tools. And he said, oh, I prefer to do it the older way because I get time to live with my work.
Right.
And I feel that still to this day. You know, I'm working on a couple of tracks now, and I probably will sit with them for about 2 weeks as I work with them, because a speed is not really a great helper. Time is a great collaborator. It allows you to live with it for a while and make changes. And that's what the digital world doesn't let us do. It doesn't let us live with things for very long. We're told to move at ridiculous speed. And that's not really great for terrific art, you know, just not really great. So for me, whenever I talk to even, you know, people about editing and the speed of working with digital, it's all great, it's all useful, but you try and build into that a time of standing back and going, well, let's live with this for a bit, because we seem to be motivated with just getting a result and not if we're doing great work. So I think that makes a statement, that filmmaker was saying, I like to work slightly in the old way, as I do with my analog keyboards, because it gives you a slight sense to step back and see if you're doing something emotional.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing, too, about it is, like, you know, I look at these players online, and there's, like, 10-year-olds, 12, 15-year-olds who can shred on guitar, they can play really well.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I think Lukather also said it in the Beato interview. He said, you know, if they play live, they're like 3 bars ahead sometimes, or they're like, you know, so like when they're actually playing to it with the band or even with the track, it's like the feel isn't there. And I think, you know, like I just started playing guitar again. I'm terrible, but I started playing again. And I'm itching to play with the drummer so that I can actually play, you know, get into that groove and do those silly things, those basic things. And, you know, so many people, I mean, you know that as a musician, but it's interesting to discover that and see, like, you know, what not to do. You know what I mean? In this modern era, as I'm playing again, there's certain things I want to do, like play with the band, you know, hone my craft, you know, but also not do those things that, you know, those shortcuts that can mess things up, you know, and there's so many shortcuts that just, you know, that kind of can't, you know, shortchange the overall.
You know, it's a fantastic thing you're saying there, Dave, because, you know, I'm finishing my Radio Owlsnest shows on the 50th show, but around the edges, I've been doing something that I've always wanted to do. I've taken all my vinyl records down from out of the loft, and I'm doing a radio show called Going Down the Rabbit Hole with Martin Page, and I will actually play these tracks that influenced me from the 60s and 70s and 80s and made me a musician and a bass player and a songwriter. And I've started to do these shows, and I'm actually playing the tracks that I learned from, and a few of the tracks that are actually, you know, my songs that were recorded by the artist. And I found myself talking about the feel of real bands in the 70s playing together, mm-hmm. and I was a bass player. So I had to join with the drummer. I had to understand his rhythm, his feel. And there is a thing that happens in those records when the band ignites together and moves together and tempos slightly change. It's a wonderful, wonderful, special thing that you can hear in these bands. And in fact, I did one of these radio Going Down the Rabbit Hole yesterday, and I was playing an Isley Brothers track, you know, called Pride. And you're listening to the funk of this track and the bass player and the clavinet player, and there's nothing that you could emulate like that. And there's nothing like James Brown. And it's a wonderful thing that young kids don't really, as you say, get much of a chance now. You go on to YouTube and you see them shredding, like Lukather says, and they're amazing technically. But once you get with other human beings and you're trying to create an overall sound, there is a magic that takes place, a feel. And I've been talking quite a bit about that on these shows because I'm playing those records from that era that made me want to be a bass player. And still, I mean, it's funny, yesterday I sat down and listened to the top 10 that's out now, and I listened to it and I could hear how clever they were and everything, you know, and if we could swear even more in it, you know, wonderful. if we could put in there as many times as we can, there's a hit there. And some of the tracks were, they were good and clever. But I noticed there's no guitar. Maybe one. That's because we know that country music is sort of touching on rap now. But also there was none there that I felt, oh, that was played by a band. It's rare. It's just really rare. And I think that's something that is a missing magic. You know, a lot of kids when they first hear Led Zeppelin, you know, now, like my drummer's son who, you know, just really discovered Led Zeppelin, and he can't believe when he hears Black Dog or hears Whole Lotta Love. He can't believe how that sounds, and he can't put his finger on it why it sounds like that. You know, and we're going, well, they played it live, and they were a band together. You know, and the kids don't they can tell there's something special there. It's just that we're not seeing it a lot these days because we're actually joined like robots to digital, the digital era. You know, everything can be done by pushing a button. So that's vanishing a little bit. I hope that it comes around again, and especially as you say earlier with AI coming in, there's a bit of trepidation there. Like even more, we're going to lose, like you playing your guitar with another musician. There's something absolutely human about that, and quite magical. I mean, music wasn't meant to be just one person pushing his finger down onto a keyboard. It was about communication and playing together and creating together. So I hope that we hold on to that as AI starts to become very predominant.